Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? It can be both my Christmas and birthday present. There are two types of con artist movies in the world. Those made before The Sting and those made after. Winner of 7 Academy Awards in 1973 and the godfather of every slick, twist-heavy heist movie from Matchstick Men to Ocean's 11, The Sting manages to be an incredible caper while also commenting on loneliness, the American dream, and the art of movie-making itself. It even inspired my own novel, Chasing the Ace. This week on Scammapalooza, I talk to Matthew Spector, co-founder of the LA Review of Books and author of The Sting, a book analysing The Sting and its place in movie history. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Absolutely loved your book. It manages to pack a huge amount of information about The Sting and its legacy into what is a very slim little volume. How did the book come about?
The series editor called me and he said, do you want to write a short book about a film, any film? And I said, sure. And I had signed on initially to write about Fight Club, curiously, because I worked on Fight Club a little bit. And I thought, oh, I have stories about it. And then when time came for me to start writing the book, I was sitting there one night just dreading it, just thinking, why can't I start this book? And I looked over at the TV and The Sting was on. And I thought, man, I wish I were writing a book about The Sting. And I just thought, well, that's what I should do instead.
Did you tell them beforehand, or did you just present them with a manuscript?
I didn't bait and switch them. I called them and I said, listen, I really don't want to write about Fight Club. Can I write about The Sting instead? But you know, every one of those books, we were really allowed, you know, absolute carte blanche in terms of what we wanted to write about.
My first interaction with the movie was reading the Mad Magazine parody.
Right, which was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, all those parodies they did in the 70s were amazing. Yeah. But I certainly remember that too. That was around the same time as I would have been seeing the movie.
I read the parody and it seemed like this fun caper, and they glossed over some of the more dark, depressing, bleak parts of the movie.
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to write about it was because I feel like it's a movie that, at least in the States, was a little bit misinterpreted as being this kind of an entertainment or a confection. I mean, obviously, it is a highly entertaining movie, but I think, you know, some people think it's outrageous that it won the Academy of the War Award in the same year that, you know, I mean, what were its competitors? Just Taxi Driver, you know, there were all these heavyweight American films that came out the same year. And certain people like Pauline Kael and many others rolled their eyes a little bit at The Sting and said, oh, you know, this is a really, you know, like glossy, lightweight movie. And I don't think it's particularly lightweight at all. I actually think it's, you know, both the sort of political implications of it and the tonal suggestions of it. I mean, you mentioned it does have some very melancholy aspects and some I think much darker aspects than is, you know, widely credited.
I think that's part of the success as a movie, both commercially and artistically, is you can enjoy it on several different levels. I think you can enjoy it as a disposable caper film and not think too hard about it and just enjoy the twists and turns of the story and dispose of the rest if that's what you want to do. I know I certainly did when I was a lot younger, and it's only repeated watching I've gotten a little bit more out of it.
Well, that was the other, I think, the other big thing about it for me when I was a kid is that I was completely, I mean, I was probably 7 when I saw that movie, and it's one that, you know, even most, but somewhat by design, you know, adults can watch it and, you know, when they see it the first time, they're like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
It's not the most immediately legible movie. And I loved it right away, you know, even at a time when I knew I wasn't able to understand a good portion of it. And there's something very beguiling about learning to love something that you know you're not getting all of.
Reminds me a little bit of watching Shakespeare, which I know is like, what, that's classic. Yeah, who's an English major here? Everything is Shakespeare. But it is that, you know, the language is impenetrable at times, and they're using all of this correct but old-fashioned con artist lingo that you're not really supposed to understand as the cackle bladders and inside man and ropers and all this sort of talk and the wire. They keep talking about the wire and they demonstrate the wire, but they never really specifically explain it to you. And it's the same as Shakespeare, and that a modern audience might miss a lot of the words and a lot of the nuances, but they still get the gist of it. And that I think
it works because it means you're both an insider learning all these kind of words and terminology and secrets, but at the same time you are an outsider in that you're not 100% sure what's going on.
Right. Which is, you know, one of the part of the movie's ingenuity is that it sort of places you in, you know, in both spots. You're aligned with the con men, but you're as ignorant as the mark, you know, which is unusual.
Well, it was unusual. This is the thing. It's now The Sting is one of those movies that has not only become iconic in and of itself, but it has created an entire genre of copycats of films just use that exact same structure. And now I was talking last week to Lawrence Leung, who's an Australian comedian and writer, who's just his new film Sucker has just come out, which is a con artist movie. And he said that there is that expectation that you're going to follow, your film is going to follow the same beats as The Sting. Even if the audience hasn't seen The Sting, they expect a certain setup and then a certain sort of turn in the middle and then a twist in the tail. And if that The Sting style twist isn't there, it feels as if something might be missing.
Yeah. Although, you know, what's interesting is I was thinking about, you know, I guess the first descendants of The Sting that I really remember seeing were things like, you know, like those David Mamet movies in the 80s, you know, like House Games or The Spanish Prisoner, both of which seem directly indebted to something like The Sting. And both of which seem to, I mean, they're also enjoyable movies, but they sort of evaporate once you're done with them. You're sort of like, oh, well, that's that, you know? There's nothing about those movies. I mean, they're nice to see, but I've never been drawn back to them. The interesting thing about this movie in particular is that even once, you know, sometimes when you have a very elaborate, you know, kind of narrative mechanism like that, you get to the end and you sort of, oh, I see how it works. And then there's nothing, you're not really left with anything, you know, you're just sort of like, oh, there, you know, kind of evaporates. And I think The Sting sort of is a story that manages its own, you know, not just to pull off the trick, but to leave you feeling like you've gained something substantial in watching it, oddly, you know? I mean, even when I was a kid, I feel like the ending of the movie is really, I always found the ending of the movie very poignant in a way. I can't really think of others that seem quite so melancholy and affecting in a strange way.
I'd argue Matchstick Men is one that...
I
think has that sort of sadness at the end of it. It's not triumphant in its
right.
twist. I don't want to give away the ending. I mean, we're obviously going to talk about The Sting and the twist, and if someone hasn't seen The Sting by now, then
I've seen it so many times, and I don't think the pleasure diminishes for knowing how it turns out.
Yeah, that's right. It's still a great film without spoiling the twist. But I've had complaints on previous episodes because we talked about Nightmare Alley. Not many people have seen Nightmare Alley, and so we talked about it and deconstructed and pulled apart, and at the halfway through everyone was like, oh, I really want to go and watch this film. And then by the end of the episode, we'd kind of spoiled the movie because we'd explained everything that happens in detail and analyzed it and picked it apart, and there was nothing left. But I feel like The Sting is, as we said, it's a cultural, you know, icon, and if people haven't seen it, I think I'd be very surprised, so that's fine. One of the things is about the movie that is striking to me is how much the filmmakers want to remind you the whole way through that you are watching a movie. It begins with showing you the faces of all of the actors, and rather than saying, this is Henry Gondoff and this is, you know, Hooker, and these are all the different people, it says, this is Robert Redford, and shows you Robert Redford, and here he is, look, it's Robert Redford acting. And if at any moment you forget that maybe you're watching a movie, it will stop and put one of these, you know, old-fashioned title cards on the screen just to constantly remind you that this is a movie, because and that obviously plays into it, because the movie itself is a con, and it's you're being made to feel as if you're part of it, and you're being told everything, but really you're not. How deliberate do you think that is on the part of the filmmaker?
It's deliberate, I think, on the part of the director. The interesting thing, as you say that, that's not, you know, David S. Ward, the writer, was when I spoke to him about it, he had said that, you know, he had written The Sting was his second script, and he had written a feature called Steelyard Blues, which I still haven't seen to this day, but, you know, which I think was a sort of gritty, you know, working class drama. And I think when he was writing The Sting, his original idea was to, you know, he was really interested in sort of making it sort of very, very gritty, you know, very to sort of have the feel of the Depression. And I don't think that he conceived of it with quite that, you know, the sort of lightness of tone that was, I mean, we talked about the score. I remember speaking with him about the score, and, you know, everybody associates it with, you know, that very jaunty, you know, Scott Joplin-y score. And he was saying that his, you know, in his original conception of it, he had wanted to use, you know, like 20s blues tunes and, you know, really, really raw, you know, musical material. So I think that that was something that was not so much written into the story, but obviously was very deliberate, you know, on the part of George Roy Hill, the director.
Well, this is part of the legacy and the curse, I think, of The Sting, is that when that story is, it is repeated over and over and over again, it does lose, not in The Sting, but that twist, that idea of the twists and turns, it just loses its potency. And you have have you ever seen the British television series Hustle?
Sure. Yeah.
And so that is essentially every episode remakes The Sting for a slightly different scam. Right. And when you're someone like me who likes to mainline con artist television shows, it just after, you know, hour seven, you see the formula and you see the cracks and it becomes mechanical in nature. Whereas The Sting, having seen it a dozen times, never seems to feel mechanical. It always feels organic and fresh.
There's a larger, you know, set of thoughts and ideas to be extracted there about you know, kind of where the movies are now too. I ran into Michael Tolkien, you know, the writer who wrote The Player and, you know, lots of other things. And he and I were kibitzing not long ago, just chatting and, you know, complaining about some film that we'd recently seen. And I said to him, God, Michael, why are the movies so terrible? And he just said, oh, we've run out of myths. I don't like things that explain complex phenomena too simply, but there is something about, you know, the state of Hollywood at the moment that really does feel like the best stories have been told, at least within a sort of 2-hour American studio film format. There's not a lot of room to wiggle, and it feels quite like a dying animal to me.
I guess that's why we have the long form stories of, you know, the sort of serialized television series now.
That's why television is so alive at the moment, I think, is simply because those possibilities haven't been explored so exhaustively.
Mm. And I think a long-form, sort of serialized con artist story that could very quickly get over the idea that you expect a twist and after two or three episodes you realize that it's not about the twist, it's about the characters. I think you could do something great with that.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. If you were able to tell a long-form story that wasn't about the successful completion of, you know, a con every week, you absolutely could do it, you know, a series like that.
Let's talk about Redford and Newman, because this was the second time they had come together. This was after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
And everyone was sort of waiting to see what they were going to do together next.
Well, you know, I think that was actually a product of, if I'm recalling correctly, you know, there wasn't really any plan in place to retain them, which again is amazing. You know, today you sort of think if any two actors get on, then you're going to see them, you know, together 15 times, you know, and they only worked together twice, right? I mean, they were really only the two movies, and the way that the original version of The Sting, or The Sting as they were developing it, was Paul Newman was not attached. They were going after Redford, you know, just Redford. And the idea that that Henry Gondorf was originally, they thought he was going to be played by someone sort of heavy, you know. They told me, in fact, that Jackie Gleason was someone that they had in mind. Like they thought of him as sort of a larger, kind of, you know, kind of real Chicago type of guy. It came about, I think, because the director George Roy Hill ran into Paul Newman, and Paul said, "What are you up to, George?" And he said, "Oh, I'm out here casting a movie," and Newman said to him, "Anything in it for me?" So when they gave him the script, he didn't really think it was right for him. He thought, well, you know, this guy's sort of, you know, he's too old. I can't play this guy. He's too old. So it took a little persuading, I think.
This is, and I think you mentioned this in the book, that this is the first time that he played old. This is his first sort of middle-aged or, you know, not a young guy character.
Yeah.
And he's only got about 10 or 12 years on Redford.
Yeah. By old, we mean 40.
Yeah.
You know,
right. Hollywood old. Right. But I think that works in that he's old enough that he can be the pseudo mentor.
It's ideal. It turns out to be ideal, but it was something of an accident that they, you know, and then I think they used him once he had agreed to do it, you know, to play that part. That was how they locked in Redford, because Redford had been vacillating a little bit. You know, he wasn't sure. He liked the script, but he didn't, you know, he wasn't sure.
The relationship between the two of them is, I'm not going to say bromance.
I think it's one of the great on-screen pairings in all of cinema, really. The chemistry between them, whatever that is, the affectionate closeness between them is just, it's beautiful. It's what makes the movie stick, I think.
And the idea in the second act that Hooker might betray Gondorf and give him up to the FBI, that sort of leads us through into the final act is legitimately heartbreaking. That he really doesn't want to do this, but he realizes that he wants to, you know, he wants revenge and he wants to do what he thinks is the right thing, and that's played so beautifully. And yet in some films when they do that, and you get this real, and this is something Hustle, the TV series, does a lot, is that they will create a genuine dramatic tension and a genuine sort of struggle for their protagonist to get through and a problem for them to solve, and then will reveal, as is revealed in The Sting, that in fact none of that is real, and the FBI are not, you know, the FBI agents are not real FBI, and everything is actually part of the scam, and that they were never enemies at all. You often feel betrayed in that you were kind of tricked, whereas in this you don't. You feel like that's entirely an acceptable way to tell that story of those characters, and that tension, even knowing how it's going to end, still remains.
It's exceptional. And obviously, when writing this book, I watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid a bunch of times again, too. And it's interesting, The Sting, I think, it's certainly the better script, with all respect to William Goldman's wonderful work in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You know, that movie feels very baggy to me. Right, which The Sting doesn't. I mean, just on the level of kind of pure narrative construction, the ingenuity of The Sting just kills it. But you know, in both movies, they have that quality. I think, you know, they're so beautifully paired.
Ocean's 11 is a movie that also I think has great pairing and great characters.
Yeah.
But you also have, in the first film, you have a similar sort of supposed falling out between Danny Ocean and, I'm going to say, Brad Pitt.
Right.
I can't remember the names of the characters in Ocean's 11, between Danny Ocean and Brad Pitt. And then it's revealed that that was all just a practical joke at the expense of one of the other members of the team. And you say, well, what was the point of that? Why you just, it was a fake. It was a feint. And there's no reason to do that.
It's pretty obvious that the Ocean's movies are the most direct descendants of The Sting that there are. Right. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine movies more patterned after The Sting than the Ocean's movies. And, you know, I like them, certainly very watchable, but they do seem pretty machine tooled by comparison. They just don't have they don't have the warmth, and they don't quite have the organic quality.
And they also don't have the same legacy, I think, that The Sting has. I'm an Australian, and so I view The Sting as an outsider. But for you as an American, it seems to me that the movie is held up as a classic piece of Americana. Like, it's constantly, everything's in the Library of Congress and constantly being preserved and kept and saved.
I'm never sure. And of course, you know, kind of hardcore cinema people will debate this to the end, you know, what belongs on, you know, what's a truly great American film and what's a trifle. I think the sort of hardcore cinema people that I know don't hold it in the same kind of esteem that they hold Altman's movies or Scorsese's movies or whatever. But it is interesting that, you know, that the story, you know, right after we were emailing on Sunday to set this up, I opened the New York Times and there was a big story on the front page about a guy who had basically been conned out of 760 grand by two psychics in New York City. You know, just a real classic, you know, con artist story, you know, and separately. That he'd somehow managed to allow not just one, but two people consecutively to just milk him out of every cent that he had. You know, the movie in an American context versus the movie in an Australian context. I mean, the confidence man is such a huge part of American mythology, right? It goes to Melville. It goes back to Mark Twain. Like, you know, you look at American literature and you see the confidence man sitting at the center of it.
Well, the first confidence man, literally, was an American. He was William Thompson, and that's where it comes from. And Melville, with the novel, kind of semi-popularized the term and got it out there. And you have the riverboats, and you have the Dust Bowl Depression era of the traveling grifter. And I mean, you can see that line drawn from William Thompson through Melville, and then to David Marra, who wrote the big con. There was a lawsuit, which was, I believe, settled out of court between the makers of The Sting and Mara's estate. I think it was his estate.
Yeah.
Because it's so close to his nonfiction work.
It's really phenomenal. I of course, was put onto that book much later, you know, at some 10, 15 years ago. Well before I wrote about The Sting, I had a friend who asked me, have you ever read The Big Con? I said, no. He said, you won't believe it. You know, and I was obviously the work that David Ward and the makers of The Sting did in terms of building an actual narrative and certainly qualifies the movie as sufficiently original. But, you know, the argot and the names and it's incredible how much that book informs the movie.
And continues to inform con artist literature and movies now and today. And you watch films in which they use terms, you know, like Inside Man and Roper and all those terms we were just talking about, and The Sting and the setup and the tail, and they continue to use that even though in the real world those terms have died out long ago. There's no, you know, the Bernie Madoff is not sitting, you know, was not sitting in his office talking about putting people on the send and, you know, someone having tin mittens and all of that kind of terminology, and yet it's stuck with us in popular culture.
And it's part of what I wanted to write about. You know, on the one hand, you know, the idea of being, you know, nobody wants to be taken, right? I mean, not for obvious reasons. Like, everybody, all of us want to think that we're, you know, that we're shrewd people. But I think there is something about cons that, you know, it's, I think sometimes for a mark, I mean, I don't want to say this because it could come off, you know, glib when, you know, having, it's never happened to me, but I feel like, you know, there is pleasure in being taken in being fooled. And I mean, a kind of elemental human pleasure, not in losing your life savings or whatever, but in being fooled by anything, you know. It's, I mean, that's sort of at the core of going to the movies. You know, we go to the movies and, you know, on some level we're buying into, you know, we're lending some credence to what we're watching, you know. And I think, you know, that to me is sort of something that The Sting addresses and you know, something that you know, just I found it rewarding to think about is, you know, on some level as human beings, we always want to be fooled. Maybe not on every level, but on some level, I think we're always wanting to be enchanted and beguiled by something.
A famous magician said, nobody minds being taken by a gentleman, which was, you know, the idea that if a magician is likable enough, people won't care that they've been fooled by him. And I think that's true. A lot of the people that I meet who are victims of small-scale scams, so, you know, three-card Monty or like a, I don't know, a Beijing tea ceremony where they've lost maybe 100, 200 bucks while being a tourist, their eyes light up when they tell the story of the time they got taken. And what happened and how it all went down.
I don't want to romanticize that because the you know, the fact is the practical aspect of being conned out of even a small sum of money is really pretty ghastly. But on a kind of emotional or metaphysical need, there I do believe there's a human impulse to be tricked.
that said, The Sting does romanticize the world of the con artist,
perhaps more than a little.
And it part of the way in which it does that is to take people who should be unlikable because they are criminals and do take advantage of people's weakness, and firstly cast them with extraordinarily charming, good-looking, talented actors, but also by presenting them with a victim who is far worse than they are. So the con artists become the lesser of two evils.
That's also very consonant with, you know, the moment the movie was made in the early 70s, and it was kind of a moment when the outlaw was being romanticized all over. I mean, you know, very, very much in the movies, you know, in things like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, so there was kind of the moment, I think, when you know, everybody aspired to be an outlaw. So, you know, you know, and that's certainly what David Ward told me too, that he was interested in writing a movie where the villain was the hero.
Particularly that time in America, you had an outlaw as president.
This is
just post Watergate. Well, at the time of Watergate, clearly there are political links between this movie and Watergate. I mean, Mad Magazine had, you know, a parody of the poster with Richard Nixon as Henry Gondoff at the front cover.
The fact that The Con and The Sting is referred to as The Wire, the wiretapping was such a, you know, such a big part of the Watergate experience too. So, you know, there was, you know, it felt even in some of its kind of particulars very consonant with Watergate, you know, and again, I think the script was probably written pre-Watergate, But that was the climate of the time.
Let's talk a little bit about our villain, who's Doyle Lonergan. Yeah. And they've gone so far out of their way to make him as unlikable as possible.
Yeah.
Sometimes in simple fact that he is an organized criminal, he's violent, he's nasty, but also they've made him a foreigner. And from memory, he is the only... He's the only clearly foreign person in the movie. Everyone else is as American as, you know, like very, very American. And he's a filthy Irishman.
Yeah.
With a limp, no less, which...
Yeah. Well, you know the story behind that, right? I think I tell it in the book. Robert Shaw suffered, I think he hurt himself playing tennis. But right before they started filming, he hurt himself. So the limp was sort of an accident as well. And they just decided that it played well. They liked that, you know. It made him look rough.
I'm constantly presented with, because I perform and do shows, and my books are read by a lot of young men come up and say, oh, yeah, I read your book about the con artist. Yeah, I really want to be a con man. And, and you can excuse all this behavior by just saying, well, the victim deserves it for some reason. How much do you think The Sting and movies like The Sting are responsible for that romanticization and that making being a con artist somehow a desirable profession?
I think that there is some romance inherent within the narrative itself. I mean, if you go back to the Big Con, right, to David Maurer's book, it's, you know, I think about the lingo and the argot and, you know, this is a profession that to some extent is romanticizing itself. You know, I mean, yeah, of course, you know, the movies tend to present the profession with some glamour. And that is probably, I'm sure there are people who take that quite to heart. But I also think I think this is true of so many professions where there's a fully developed internal language and vernacular that I think there's some romance involved. I think, you know, I think other cons probably do this as well. Again, not that I've been one or spent a lot of time, you know, in any context where there's a specialized expertise and there's a pride that develops in having that expertise, which there clearly is. You know, if you look at primary sources for, you know, and records of, you know, the actual con men themselves of the, you know, late 19th century, early 20th, you know, these were people that took some pleasure in their skill and in the stories they were able to tell about their skill, right? I mean, half the pleasure of a con is recounting the con or reliving the con. You know, can you believe what I just did? And I think the romanticism probably enters into it there, wouldn't you think?
I guess it is that classic argument about violence in movies.
Yeah.
Does playing Grand Theft Auto make you more likely to commit road rage, and does The Sting make you more likely to become a professional con artist?
I will say, you know, it strikes me as I'm saying this that certain people close to me have had this experience. One of my immediate family members was had an employee who embezzled a lot of money from them, and someone else that's very close to me had their family was very affected by Bernie Madoff, and you know I've been you know in the kind of immediate blast radius of that experience before, and there's not a lot of romance there. I do knew the person who did the embezzling, and they were just crazy and really sort of a fairly pathetic figure rather than a. You know, I don't think that this was an instance where someone was congratulating themselves on their own cleverness. I think it was a compulsion, and like many compulsions, kind of propagated in a spirit of shame and discomfort.
Can we talk about some of the weaker moments, or what I see as perhaps the weaker moments in the film? The main one is Celino, who befriends and then beds Hooker, only to actually be a hit woman who is about to rub him out on behalf of Lonergan, our villain. Aside from the cliche of the femme fatale, of the woman you love, you know, turning around and trying to shoot you, that cliche, she doesn't seem to work as a plot device at all. She has so many opportunities to rub him out, and doesn't really take many of them until right at the end of the film.
Yeah, well, Demetra Arliss, who plays the part, she's actually quite a wonderful actress, I think. I enjoy her whenever I see her. You know, obviously, I asked David Ward about that. You know, why doesn't she kill him earlier?
What's the deal with your crappy character?
There are valid reasons. I mean, you know, or I should say technically valid reasons. You know, it's always it's always excusable. Well, you know, there are, you know, there were people present, or there was this or that. You know, we walked through it. You know, I think the real truth is just the narrative mechanics of the movie require, you know, it's very, I mean, given how tightly wound the story is, I don't think that there was really much of an alternative. I'll put it that way. Yeah. It's never bothered me all that much. I mean, you know, I guess I feel like that's not the only hole in the movie by any means. You know, there are a couple others.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a point in the film where someone else is trying to kill him and she helped him escape. And then kills the person who is trying to kill Hooker herself, which is just literally like, why not just let him do the job for you? And I don't know, is she working on commission? I don't know what the story is. It just for a film that is so strong and, as you said, so tightly wound and so carefully plotted, that character seems to be there to provide him with some comfort and to really kind of point out the loneliness of the confidence man. Because all of the characters in the movie, despite that camaraderie, are quite lonely.
Pointing in a number of ways, and it's also something that it also just strikes me as. Well, it's a very masculine world, that film. I'll put it to you that way. There really aren't the female characters in the movie. You know, there's her. There's Eileen Brennan. You know, plays the madam, right, who owns the whorehouse that Henry Gondorf is sleeping in.
Yeah.
But you know, they all seem, each of those characters seems a little, shall we say, lightly developed.
Yeah.
You know, a little flimsy and. Certainly, Selena is a character who really exists only to serve whatever the immediate needs of the plot are just then. You know, if Redford needs a rescuer in this scene, she'll be the rescuer.
But that said, I think you are right in that her performance is great and that she doesn't come across as ditzy and she doesn't come across as the innocent or the naive kind of waif who's been dragged into this world.
And she was also curiously, I think, a little bit hard to cast insofar as, you know, I think they wanted someone hard boiled and Redford, if I recall correctly, put up some resistance because he didn't think she was good looking enough. For his character to, you know, insofar as she's also a romantic interest for his character, he was sort of reluctant to cast her. He sort of felt, you know, shouldn't Johnny Hooker be sleeping with a better looking dame?
Can you imagine being that actress and finding that out and then getting, but we're going to give you the role anyway. Now you've got to do a love scene with this guy.
It's hard to be surprised anymore by the vanity of any leading man. But I think Redford was pretty, you know, high on his own prettiness at the time that movie was being made.
he is extraordinarily attractive in the movie.
He is very good looking in that movie. That's for damn sure.
A lot of the reviews mention his good looks as being distracting, and his platinum blonde hair and his shiny teeth.
Yeah.
If it was a true Depression era film, he should have been missing a couple. And just,
exactly. Yeah. Well, right. Sure.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie, and because I have a, you know, history as a lover of magic and card technique, is the poker game in the train carriage.
It's such a tour de force. It's great.
It's so well done. And I was talking to this to Lawrence Long, who also has sort of a card cheating scene and used in his movie and used this, watch The Sting, that scene from The Sting over and over and over again, just to, you know, see how they sort of pulled it off. And he noticed there's no music at all in that intro.
Yes,
and very
no underscore. So in that scene especially, just because it's set on a train and you have that kind of, you know, the sort of ambient noises of just the train itself undercutting, you know, the incredible tension of that scene.
And also the beautiful setup in the cabin beforehand where he's practicing his sleight of hand, and you see his hands shake and stutter see him taking a few swigs of gin. And so as he's drunk throughout that game, you're not sure if this is him as a drunk, which he was, you know, when he's first introduced, or him pretending to be drunk, I think captures the essence of the film, where you can't tell what is the actor acting drunk or what is the actor acting acting like they're drunk.
Thing about that scene actually was that Walter Hill insisted, or George Roy Hill, sorry, wrong Hill, George Roy Hill insisted that all the card stuff that happened on camera, so that none of that was really, and that was true for the rehearsal too. They didn't you know, they didn't allow that stuff to be, you know, to happen off screen. All of the actual movement of the cards had to be tracked and seen on camera.
Yeah, and that means that if you as the viewer miss something,
yeah,
when you're watching it, you feel like you've been misdirected in exactly the same way as the players around the table have. Which is great. I noticed they do slow it down a lot. It's particularly when they switch in the cooler, when they swap the stack deck for the Lonergan stacks, that he does it very, very, very slowly and puts it in his lap and kind of takes his hands away so the camera can see, and then folds it up in a handkerchief and dabs his mouth and puts it in his pocket, which is something, again, Lawrence Lung was saying last week, was that when they shot all the card work, they had to slow everything down because if you do it at speed, you've got to give your viewer a fighting chance to try and figure out exactly what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Actually, I mean, that's a big thing with these types of films, is that you do need... They do play out a little bit like murder mysteries, in that you do have to feel as if you could have figured out how it was done and what happened. And if you're not given that information, you do feel a little bit cheated. If at the end there's a whole lot of... I mean, again, Ocean's 12... Nobody likes Ocean's 12 because a lot of reasons, but one of them is you just have no chance of ever figuring out their needlessly complicated twist at the end. It's just such a, you know, a massive act of sleight of hand that you feel a little bit cheated. And here you could figure out what's going on. You already know that there are people playing various characters, and you know that no one is what they seem. And so you should be able to figure out what's going on. But I can't imagine many audiences at the time, and even now, would necessarily figure the whole thing out.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. I think I'm going to road test that theory, actually, because I'm oddly supposed to host a screening of The Sting, or co-host a screening of it, this weekend.
Just before I let you go, you have a book coming out?
I think I wrote The Sting immediately after I had, actually, right, it was right when I was in the middle of my novel American Dream Machine, which came out here and in Australia as well, I think in 2013. And then I just finished it. I'm just finished a new novel, and my agent just sent it out. So I don't know yet when that's going to appear, but I'm guessing 2017.
And people can find out more at matthewspector.com.
Neither spelled like nor related to Phil.
You have to do that a lot, don't you?
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.